I'm returning a baby carriage.
Are you married?
Why, of course not.
Then what are you doing with a baby carriage?
Welcome to the Marx Brothers Council Podcast. I'm Emilio Estevez, and this is episode 68, Miscellany Business. As always, our producer Bob Gassell is on the knobs and in the background and may or may not be tempted to join in at any stage. And with me in our transatlantic virtual studio, as always, is Noah Diamond. And lucky we are to have him, because if you're listening to this in the year 3163... A, don't you think it's about time you change those curtains? And B, let it be known that as we record this, we are but a lick and a spit away from Marxfest 2024. So Noah, how are you and how is it?
I am fine and it is fine. It may be doing better than I am right now. I'm very excited about Marxfest, but sleep is but a distant memory and something I'm looking forward to perhaps in early June.
Well, our guest this time is Trav Esty, who we last spoke to back in episode 14, Look at Ciccolini. For those of you who may have missed that one, he's a writer, performer, director, the author of the books No Applause, Just Throw Money and Chain of Fools, of the website Travelanche, and also a prime mover behind the sagas of Marxfest and the I'll Say She Is revival. But he's with us today because he has a new book ready to be received, and it's called The Marx Brothers Miscellany. So hello and welcome, Trav Esty.
When you say received, Matthew, I hope you don't mean like in the horse feather sense where like somebody pitches it and then somebody else catches it and then spikes it in the end zone. thank you for having me back. It's wonderful. It feels like it's been ages. It's been, what, 5 years? Something like that?
It has been a frighteningly long time. And as you were saying earlier, that was back in the pre-video link days, so we couldn't even see each other. We were just disembodied voices.
And Matthew, I also wanted you to know, I'm going to start with a little flattery. I watched last night, just coincidentally now, I watched the Abbott and Costello TV show. Which I love. Not to change the subject, but I happen to love the Abbott and Costello TV show. Not the movies, not so much. I say this to inoculate myself.
I've read you saying some very naughty things about Lee Costello. I have to say, if you want to open that kind of words.
I enjoyed your episode where you tried to get Noah to sign off on them. I'll sign off on them partially, but anyway, I enjoy the TV show.
It's always a treat when we find something to disagree about on this show.
Well, we had your Marx origin story back in episode 14. So if anybody who's listening needs a recap, hurry there now and we'll wait for you. Welcome back. So, Trav, we won't make you repeat any of that, but I do want to ask you specifically about the book's origin story. What are we getting here, and how come you decided to add another tome to the Marxian pile?
Well, I guess, you know, it's ad hoc. We have this big festival coming up. Actually, I was working on a completely different book about television and radio variety shows, which is still in progress. But it occurred to me, I've long wanted to start adapting these like reams and reams of material that I generated for the blog and see if I could make, turn them into books. And so that was the idea behind this one. This is the virgin one. It's not all off the blog, by the way. When I started to compile it, I realized, oh, this element is missing, that's missing, this is a talk I've never given, and so forth. So a good chunk of it ended up being generated specifically for the book. But a lot of it's also from the blog. And so if it has a raison d'etre, I guess it's that over the past 15 years or whatever it's been that I've been writing about showbiz, vaudeville and burlesque and sideshow and so forth, I got this weird, unintentionally, I didn't set out to do this, but I kind of have kind of a window into the big picture of the world the Marx Brothers moved in when they were in vaudeville, that you know, if you're narrowly focused on the movies, you might not get, for example.
That's one of the things I think is most valuable about your take on the Marx Brothers, Trav, is that you really center the vaudeville part of their story, which is the major part of their story. I mean, I think most Marx Brothers fans, for very good, understandable reasons, dramatically overvalue the film years, which were a fairly small part of the career, really. And I think I overcorrect for that sometimes by absurdly overvaluing the Broadway years. But really, vaudeville was the substantial part of their career. It's how, where and how they became who they were. And through your eyes, vaudeville is always at the center. Everything they do after vaudeville is an outgrowth of their vaudeville years.
They were in it for 15 years. Can you imagine? Very few performers, nowadays, I can't imagine many people sitting still for working on their craft for that long prior to making it. They'll throw in the towel before that. And they just kept going. There kept being some new reason to stay in, right?
Yeah.
They made the big time. They made Broadway. They made movies. All sorts of reasons not to quit. And then even when they grew apart, they went into TV.
But even as a TV star, I mean, Groucho, by the time You Bet Your Life is a big deal on television, Groucho tended to diminish the films in order to emphasize that what he was doing currently was his big thing. But he talked about TV in vaudevillian terms. You know, he said TV was the new vaudeville, and everything was through that prism. That was show business to these guys.
You got that sense from his correspondence when he was writing to people like Fred Allen and Goodman Ace and people like that. You got the sense that they were chatting about the same business, kind of, that they'd always taken part in.
So to listeners who haven't yet seen the book, let's just let them know exactly what they're in for. This isn't a book necessarily to be read from cover to cover, is it? It's the kind of book you have.
It would be helpful to be on LSD. And it's one of the reasons I'm called Trav-SD. It's not laid out in a linear way. It's mostly more like a book of essays. Although when you get to the second half, it's almost in a dictionary or encyclopedia form, because it just so happens that I'd written about tons of the people. People who newer fans often dismiss, right? We watch the Marx Brothers movies and we think they're the be-all and end-all. And who are they? Who are these stuffed pieces of furniture that they, you know? And then gradually over time, obviously, Margaret Dumont is the first, probably the, you know, our fifth Marx brother, so-called. And then gradually you discover, like, all of the, generally speaking, the people who play these minor characters and their directors, who are often belittled by Groucho in later years, were all significant people. You know, some of them had amazing movie careers. But when you watch a Marx Brothers movie, they're just like the cigar store Indians or the tackle dummies that are there to be knocked over, knocked down.
Well, what we want to do over the next hour or so is to just highlight some of the things in the book that kind of caught our eye to whet the appetite of anybody who's listening. But just a couple of general things to clear up first. In the book's subtitle, you do refer to the Marx Brothers as the world's greatest comedy team, to which I do feel an obligation to say, what about Laurel and Hardy? What about the Three Stooges? What about Monty Python?
Buffalo and Schuster.
So how do you justify this outrageous claim?
Well, I actually did a blog post listicle of world's best movie comedy teams, and I committed the heresy in that list of putting the Marx Brothers quite far down, because about half their movies are ones that we cherish, and they didn't make many movies to begin with. So I mean, when I think of them as the world's greatest comedy team, I'm including vaudeville and Broadway, radio and TV, the other media, their solo careers. I mean, they even wrote books, two of them, and really did one more book, and the other wrote a few books. Laurel and Hardy are tremendous, but they weren't a stage comedy team in addition to being a film comedy team. The Ritz brothers are terrible. but yeah, I think I may have put, I may have put Laurel and Hardy top on my list of best movie team, comedy teams for various reasons. But the Marxes, if you add in the stage career, in No Applause, I call them, they're kind of like the greatest vaudeville act ever. They had all the skills, especially when my boy Gummo was in the act, who could dance. You know, they could sing passably. They started out theoretically as a singing act, which I imagine was pretty terrible. They did the dialect humor, Groucho's very verbal humor, the mime that Harpo did, and, you know, whatever it is they did, the straight men did. I wish we had a picture into their stage careers, because I'd like to have seen how Gummo and Zeppo flourished a little bit more in those vehicles. I feel like both Coconuts and Animal Crackers had bigger parts for Zeppo, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's easy to overstate that too, but a little more than he had to do in the films.
And I just learned from the council, I forget who came out with this, that even Duck Soup had a romantic subplot before it was cut.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that actually pushed Zeppo over the edge and made him say, never mind, I don't even want to be part of this team anymore, was cutting his romance with Raquel Torres.
I hadn't known about that. Well, actually,
that's my inference.
I would do the same and probably commit murder.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty reasonable last straw to me.
Yeah.
It's one of those points that it seems sort of arcane outside the circles of obsessive Marx Brothers fans, but it's a perfectly logical, it holds water unequivocally. The Marx Brothers are obviously the greatest comedy team in history, but not the greatest film comedy team in history.
Yeah.
That's what could be more straightforward than that.
Yeah, I would go further and say that they're the only comedy team in history, but that's just me.
I challenge any of our listeners to name one more comedy team. I'll bet you can't do it.
When you were bringing up my the subtitle, I was afraid you were going to bring up the word subjective. That was the most careful word I put in the title. Because I think if there's one thing that sets it apart from, like, nobody can touch Robert Bader, right? He is the Marx Brothers historian par excellence. And I usually resist when people call me a historian. I feel like I'm a person who's in the theater, who makes it his job to know the history of the theater, as one should. A lot of people don't. And I'm a critic. I was trained as a critic. I've been professionally employed as a critic. And so I like to put out there that this is how I feel, you know. Sometimes I'm funny. Sometimes I gush irrationally. Sometimes I'm mean. You know, what I'm bringing to it is kind of my own personal reaction to it, as opposed to some kind of objective facts. You know, I certainly bake facts into it because you have to. You have to know the story before you can sort of opine on the story. But, it's more critical work than a historical work, I guess.
Well, you kick off with an intro from Austin Pendleton, who's not somebody I'm aware of previously kind of commenting on this specific subject area. So that's really nice. And you make the point that he was, of course, the person who shared the last bit of Groucho on the big screen that exists. I've actually heard it claimed that he's the last surviving person who ever shared a screen with Groucho on the big screen. I don't know if that's true or not, but...
And he was real young then, you know. I don't know if he was even 30 yet. It was one of his first movies.
So it was really nice to, you know, to hear from him in the book. How did you come to collar him for that job?
He's a very generous guy, you know, and I met him a few times. He has a cabaret act that he performs here in New York. He's a director, great director, and a great actor. So I've seen him do in roles and plays. As a huge longtime fan of him as somebody from comedy movies, it can be a little jarring. Because to me, like, you know, prime Austin Pendleton is what's up, Doc, you know, and I kind of always, to me, that's a pinnacle of a comedy character. And he kind of did that in a few movies. And I kind of always want that in the way that you want Eric Bloor to always be Eric Bloor. But, you know,
first movie I ever saw, the Muppet movie, Austin Pendleton.
Yeah, there you go. Right.
Simpering sidekick to the villain.
But I've also seen him play Philoctetes, the smelly Greek character in the old, you know, Greek tragedy. So he kind of does everything. I've seen him direct Tennessee Williams. So he has that perspective. He speaks very warmly about the time he spent with Groucho. He got to have dinner alone with him. They were sitting in the rowboat for hours in the pot smoking scene. waiting for, like, probably the waves to calm down, you know, so they could get the shot and so forth. So he's going to talk about this a bit.
Did he say what they were actually smoking?
That he didn't divulge.
Pumpkin.
Somebody said Groucho tried LSD, right? Was it Paul Krasner? Said Groucho tried LSD. I kind of don't believe it, but so Austin's going to be in Marx Fest. Is going to come and present at the salon. You'll have opportunity. Those who attend will have opportunity to ask him about working with Groucho.
I should also say that I think he's one of the very best things in the Billy Wilder version of The Front Page as well.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Ideally cast in that, I think.
Yeah.
Well, let's crack the book open then and just see what we find. One thing that leapt out straight at me straight away, because it was, I must confess, a term I'd not come across before, was the section Groucho as Buffon, if that's the correct pronunciation.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit more about that.
This is an obscure thing. Yeah, this comes from the clown community and, you know, folks I've worked who worked with who are sort of trained serious clowns who study in places like Paris and Toronto and so forth. And, you know, it's hard for me as an outsider to know how much of it is a put on, frankly. But there's a whole theory behind it, and it's kind of an articulated narrative that it dates to medieval times. But I really honestly don't think it has really been a thing until modern times. And a kind of anti-clown. You're using the techniques of clown. You're using, like, the grotesquerie of the weird makeup and wigs and costumes and so forth. But the characters are not there to please or entertain. Well, I know that's not true of Groucho, you know, Julius Marx, the guy. Look, the thing I love about the Marx Brothers, above all, is nonsense and irrationality. So I'm not sort of claiming that we need to impose a character on him. Because when people do that to any of the Marx Brothers characters, I feel what they formulate is smaller than what the brothers put out there as clowns, right? So you can say Groucho insults people and he's greedy and tries to swindle people. And actually, when I think of the swindle thing, lately I've been watching the later movies to try and find redeeming qualities. So I was looking at Go West not too long ago. And that one is kind of the one where he's like, you know, apart from, say, A Night at the Opera, maybe, where he's like a literal flim-flam man who's like trying to sell stolen watches or whatever, that kind of like low-grade stuff, you know. So people try and impose that on him, but it's not, he's really like, he'd much rather be funny than be mean to somebody or steal from them or whatever. But that said, there's a perverse pleasure that he takes in disruption. And if you say A, he'll say B. And, you know, he's like, wants to get his yayas out. You know, he wants to like, screw with people's heads, and that seems to be his almost like impish motivation. And it's true of all the brothers, but Groucho in particular seems to take a little, he likes to draw blood. And and not always, but, you know, and there are times when they try and make him a little, you know, in the MGM movies in particular, when he's helping the, you know, the schmuck, the Kenny Baker or whatever, they'll try and write in some lines where he's a pal who's got to help him, you know, with his, whatever his problem with, he needs money to save his circus or whatever. And that's never convincing. It's not convincing. He's, you know, he's mouthing his line, but that's not where Groucho's at. So Buffon, you know, it's there in the essay. It's some, a young person brought that up to me and I was very impressed because the guy was like, this young man, like a stand-up comedian. And I like to know that there are people going into the business who think about shit, frankly, a lot want their 15 minutes of TikTok fame by throwing poop at the camera or whatever it is. And, you know, and has its merits. Don't get me wrong. I enjoy poop throwing, but
sure. There's nothing wrong with the Ritz brothers.
Right. So, some of my best friends are Ritz brothers.
But that's a good point that you make. And I think it's in a lot of the best, certainly my favorite Groucho sequences, and a lot of the justifiably most famous Groucho sequences, he's kind of playing to two audiences, isn't he? He's playing to the audience that is actually there in the Chamber of Deputies of Fredonia or wherever, and then by extension the second audience, which is us, which is watching the first audience, and the job of the first audience is to not be amused.
Yeah.
Is to be infuriated, yeah. and alienated and so on. You know, and our job is to laugh at both of them, at Groucho and of them, which would be lost, I think, if either they were enjoying themselves or they weren't there.
Yeah, and I love that he includes us. We're like his confederates, usually. I think that's kind of true of all the brothers. We're in on it with them, which is very fun. That's like takes us back to the childlike place in our brains and kids' theater and panto and all of that.
It's also in some ways one of the more conventional things about them, right? Like identifying with the protagonists.
Yeah.
It's just that in the case of the Marx Brothers, the protagonists are so unconventional.
Yeah, and they don't care. They don't care if they find the painting. They don't care if they find the Bogart, really.
I also love the idea, something like Groucho as Buffon, as a way of looking, Buffon, as a way of looking at the brothers through from a different angle that doesn't have to be an all-purpose key that unlocks everything about them. It's just one perspective, one way of thinking about them,
yeah,
that can lead you to things.
Yeah, like a critical tool, right, yeah.
Yes, a critical tool. It reminds me a lot of Charlene Fix's book, Harpo Marx as Trickster, which is a really interesting exploration of the idea that Harpo's character aligns uncannily with ancient mythological ideas about trickster characters and imps and satyrs and so on. And now, it's not that that is everything there is to know about Harpo. It's a specific angle on him. It's one way of understanding him and thinking about him. And it's valuable, you know. It's valuable in addition to all the other valid angles on Harpo. And I kind of think books like this book, your book, and Charlene's book, and The Anatomy of Harpo Marx, and Josh Frank's Salvador Dali book, think projects like this, I think, are the future of Marx Brothers books. Because there's only so much Robert Bader out there to write. I mean, the conventional researched biography that digs into history and reveals, you know, secrets.
Because at
of the
a
past.
Certain point, the new information, there won't be any new information to
yeah,
find.
Yeah, we're just going
to
run out of that stuff. Because as you say, partly because, as you point out, Bader has done such an exemplary job excavating that stuff. And also just because it's a fairly small world, the world of the Marx Brothers. And I think the bookshelf from this point forward will be filled and should be filled with more impressionistic Marx Brothers books.
Love that.
As an example, too, of you mentioned in passing revisiting Go West in search of nuggets of gold in Them Thar Hills. And as an indication of how impressionistic the book is, I just want to say many, many writers have tried to find the words to express the special qualities of Go West you on page 124 of the new book.
Oh, no. I feel like I'm on trial.
Have put it so succinctly in two words. You've characterized Go West as unbearable torture.
I held back a little.
You were very kind.
Yeah.
I figure you would just have a soft spot for Irving Brecker when you wrote that.
When we turn the recording off, tell us what you really think about it.
After a while, I don't know if you guys feel the same way. I'll never stop loving their best movies, but at a certain point, the drug don't work anymore. And I'm like looking for new thrills. And, and so I've been trying to watch the later ones. I've watched them more than probably most people have. And yeah, they're just there for some other reason than what we want and expect from, or came to expect from their earlier movies. That's all.
Going back to what we were talking about earlier, though, about it interpreting their characters and the risks, potential risks of that. I mean, I think we are all guilty of, if indeed guilt is justified, of looking at certain things and saying, well, I don't like that because it's not in character. It's not what that character would do. And I think you have to sometimes sort of stop and think, well, would I be so worried about that if I happen to find it funny anyway? It's more that you just don't find it funny and you're kind of looking for some peg to hang that on. And that's the obvious one that suggests itself. And I mean, the obvious example for me, and it really is just for me, is the business with the cigars in At the Circus, which mm-hmm. a lot of people hate. And a lot of people say they hate because it's, you know, out of character. I can see that it's completely out of character. I just happen to quite find it pretty funny. That's just me. But for that reason, it doesn't bother me. And I think, I can't imagine whatever they must have said when they got those later scripts and looked at them, if they looked at them at all, what they thought, what they said. I can't really imagine under any circumstances any of them saying, my character wouldn't do that.
Right. It's funny you bring up that bit. I feel like it just kind of needs some tweaking, you know, like Chico is torturing Groucho in that scene. And that's kind of what Abbott does to Costello, right? It's kind of like, yeah, that works great for them. You know, like he keeps torturing, keeps asking, with Chico as the Abbott and Groucho as the Costello. But, you know, Groucho's not dumb. So why does he? So like as a bit, I don't mind it. But somehow it feels like a shoe that doesn't fit or something.
Well, you have an interesting take on the later films, and particularly the use of Chico in them as a character and performer. I mean, we've often noticed on this show, and you sort of note it in the book too, in a way, how Chico loses his so much of his comedic currency after the Paramount films, or really after the Aviator speech in A Night at the Opera. You know, it's kind of the last time we get to see anything like comic genius from Chico Marx. On the other hand, the persona that he sort of settles into in the later films, you argue very convincingly that is right down the middle of the road that those films are set in.
You actually refer to the Chico years,
yeah,
as a kind of a very ironic sort of catch-all term for those later films.
Yeah, well, they rewrote him to be somebody who works into the plot seamlessly. Because obviously, of them, he's the one who can move plot stuff, because Groucho is kind of aloof and above it, and Harpo is crazy and mute. And so Chico, you know, you just cast him as some sort of factotum, and he can run from A and B and talk to the leads and carry water between them and the brothers, yeah, and stuff like that.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about it until I read your book, but it's such an interesting point you make that in At the Circus, Chico's the guy who hires Groucho. Traditionally, that would be like Margaret Dumont would be the one. It's like if in Animal Crackers, if Emmanuel Ravelli was the one who, you know, booked Captain Spaulding to be at the party.
Yeah. And another aspect of this, I think, is by the late 30s and the 40s, vaudeville was out. you know, it was kind of embarrassing to the young, the Lindy Hoppers, you know, and that's Chico's whole act, right? Is like those, you know, you call them corny puns, but actually they're really clever and original puns, those bits that they wrote for Chico in those early movies and stuff. But that was considered vaudeville humor, and that was going out, and people like Bob Hope were coming in, who were kind of average American Joes kind of representing. So, you know, what do you do with Chico? They try to make him like a real Italian. You know, like in the big store when he meets somebody from back in the village or whatever, because can't do the puns anymore. And it's like, ay.
Yeah, it's interesting insight into how hard it is to write comedy, and particularly how hard it is to write for the Marx Brothers, that it's actually easier to make decisions like, all right, he's from Naples, he runs into people from the old country. Like, that's 1,000 times easier than writing a gag like Dallas Taxes.
Utterly. Yeah, that is like, to me, it's like, that is Bach, that little sequence in Duck Soup where, you know, he's questioning. It's verbal Bach.
Yeah, I think Big Store is the one, isn't it, that's most guilty of the extreme literalization of Chico, because it has that... You know, Harpo is his Italian brother. It has that grape treading business with the Italian guy in the shop, and it also starts with him using his piano skills in a vaguely constructive way, doesn't it? At this conservatory of music, so they've obviously just kind of done. Somebody said, you know, what is this guy Chico? What does he do? What's come on, just give me a brief break. What does he do?
They should have changed the conservatory to a whorehouse.
Yes,
and then we'd believe it.
That creates a nice segue to another interesting sort of mini essay, and that's I think a good way to characterize this book, as a sort of collection of mini essays, and a couple of maxi essays as well. But you make some interesting your discussion about how affected the Marx Brothers' humor was by the implementation of the production code. It's another relatively unexplored angle. That you have some interesting points to make about.
Yeah, well, someone else brought that up on the council, you know, and they sort of presented it as like a fait accompli, like it's a thing everybody knows. And I was like, I hadn't really... Because we say that, you know, and about like Mae West, for example, it's pretty clear with Mae West that she was really hurt by the code. And I had to give it some thought and actually went back and watched their earlier movies versus some of their later ones, and did see that a lot about their characters was just kind of scrubbed, you know? And I think of like, in the Coconuts, they're like, they go right to the cash register and empty it, you know, that's just what they do. And it's really funny, or Harpo always stands next to somebody so that his pocket, so they put away their thing in his pocket. You know, that's kind of like the fabric of what their characters are. But if you can't steal or lie or cheat without some kind of justification for it, you're kind of like, we don't want them to be goody two shoes.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't something that I was particularly kind of bowled over by, you know, because there are so many other factors that you have to account for that are really, really important as to why that change happens. But it is interesting that a lot of the changes to them in the MGM years do make sense if you view it through that prism. The idea that Chico, as we've just been saying, starts fleecing and torturing Groucho rather than other people is because that's, you know, that's the person he's still allowed to do that to. That's why they're up against bad guys.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The reason why they have villains in those films is because, of course, they're allowed to cheat and fleece villains.
Right.
But they can't just go up to, you know, the guy in the lobby and steal his waistcoat anymore.
We just had the Sting just turned 50 years old a few months ago, and it occurred to me while rewatching that after many years, you know, one reason it's okay that they're like have an army of con men in this movie anyway is that they're the victim of their big con is a gangster who killed their friend. You know, it kind of makes it okay when you're getting the bad guy doing something bad, but only if you're getting the bad guy with it.
is an interesting point to be made about that during the pre-code film years and during the Broadway years, the Marx Brothers probably enjoyed a lower degree of censorship and editorial interference than at any other time in their career. In other words, wasn't vaudeville had a similarly restrictive cleanliness mandate that actually has a lot more in common with the Hays Code, right, than with what was going on the New York stage in the 20s or Hollywood in the 30s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You'd be fined or fired in vaudeville if you did something dirty or, say, critical of the president, stuff like that. But I think the smarter comedians, and particularly if you're nonsensical like the Marx Brothers, you could get away with all kinds of stuff because it would go over the head of whatever manager was doing the censorship. So, like, I think of, like, a stage moment where he's, like, he goes, like in Animal Crackers, when he goes, this magnificent chest, no, this magnificent chest, no, this magnificent, you know, I'm sure that was ad-libbed, like, on the spot, and it's probably not in any script presented to a censor to have to, you know, and so that inclination of theirs, you could sort of subvert and get around the titular rules. No pun intended.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things in the MGM films that actually don't stand up to that kind of scrutiny once you think about them. For instance, if you think about Day at the Races, Groucho's character there, we often say, you know, how they've made him a real animal doctor, you know, to give him some kind of substance. But the point is, he's still deceiving Margaret Dumont in an extremely unpleasant and illegal way, presumably just to get her money. And, you know, that hasn't changed remotely. And even in something like The Big Store, I mean, they even actually have a joke. It's one of the funnier bits in the film, I think, when at the end Groucho says, I told you in the first reel he was a crook. But what that kind of reveals is that Groucho has gone and started going for Grover long before he knew. You know, we know he's a villain.
Yeah.
But Groucho doesn't know that when he's doing it. So it is kind of lip service, isn't it?
Indeed. You're reminding me, you know, before we're talking about comedy moments that aren't Marx Brothers-like that I'm okay with. And one of them for me is in The Big Store. Even though it's stuntmen, I like the image of the three of them on roller skates. And Noah will disagree with me, but I kind of love the climax of At the Circus, where, like, Maggie's, like, being hurled from a cannon and stuff like that. That's like going past Marx Brothers into, like, some other more generic realm of comedy movie making. But I don't mind it per se. I don't resent moments like that.
Yeah, I more or less agree. I mean, my feeling is that there's nothing wrong with ending a comedy film with a bang, provided you've got your money's worth in the previous hour.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, some of the W.C. Fields films, for instance, end with very elaborate slapstick sequences. And that's fine because you've got an hour of pure Fields first.
Yeah.
I mean, with Circus and Big Store, obviously, the problem is you're feeling a bit short-changed.
You have to sit through the Tenement Symphony first.
But I don't, like you, it doesn't bother me, you know, intrinsically.
Yeah. The only part of Go West that ever makes me, like, look up from, you know, what I'm reading at the same time I'm watching Go West is the stuff that Frank Tashlin and Buster Keaton worked up for, that train stuff, you know, the train's out of control. But yeah, you have to sit through the hour and a half that precedes it.
Let's talk about the piece you wrote about Gummo, because obviously there's not much said about Gummo. It could be argued there's not much to be said about Gummo. Gummo is the only Marx Brother that in 68 editions of the podcast hasn't had his own podcast. But you say something which I think is very stimulating, which is, I imagine him much more in a class, status-wise, with the brothers than was Zeppo. And you point out that he did actually have a skill, which was dancing.
Yeah. That, not to shortchange Zeppo, because as we all know, that Zeppo actually was a very skilled comedian. And I guess he holds his own in when they sing Sweet Adeline and stuff like that. not to get sidetracked with Zeppo, but Cary Grant said he studied Zeppo for you know, to, in learning to be a straight man. But yeah, I imagine I'm a gummo proponent. I'm at Marxfest. I'm going to talk to him quite a bit because he kind of speaks to them as a vaudeville act. The College of Vaudeville. Who's that guy? I can't believe I don't.
Wayburn? And
Ned yes, Wayburn. Ned Wayburn's College of Vaudeville. You know, I posted, took the liberty of posting something about him because on the Marx Brothers Council page. And someone replied to the effect that, well, even though this is not like germane or whatever to our topic. And, you know, you can see for a while, for most of us, the five Paramount films is the alpha and omega of the topic of the Marx Brothers. And then you grow and all the movies are the alpha and the omega. And then it just kind of grows until you get the stage great. And of course, Ned Wayburn is important because he taught Gummo and Groucho when they were small boys to be entertainers in the first place. He was a little important. So
he also introduced them to Will B. Johnstone in
1923. Yeah, right, exactly. You know, and you know, I learned from Bader's book tons about this relation. You know, I knew that the kids had gone there, but a lot of kids did. You know, I didn't know that he had kind of helped produce some of the early acts with Minnie and so forth. So Gummo was there even before Harpo and Chico in his act. He's closer to the others in age. And he had this dancing skill. I just kind of picture him, them not being able to shut him out the way that they were able to do with Zeppo, because Zeppo is almost an entire generation younger than him. He's just by definition the kid. And I, you know, obviously, no one can be farther away from this than me. But so this is all entirely speculation. But you picture Gummo being one of the four instead of 3+1, sort of. And I also imagine, I mean, Zeppo was self-conscious. Harpo was self-conscious because he wanted to stop delivering the dialogue. He didn't like having to do that. I picture an audience member of the day just like looking at the Marx Brothers and seeing the Marx Brothers. And they're all of comparable talent. Gummo is not going to stand out from the other three as some obviously untalented brother who needs to be sacked from the act. He's one of these funny brothers. And he did, like the other three, he did accents when they started out. You know, they sang together, they cavorted together, and he ended up playing the straight guy, but he's still a Marx brother. And I would have loved to have seen that in movies, you know.
Again, that's a very, very interesting point that hadn't really occurred to me before, how much of the otherness of Zeppo isn't just because, you know, all those standard answers, oh, there's only room for three comedians, blah, 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 blah. But the fact that he was their kid brother, he was their little kid in the act, you know, whereas Gummo was very much of the same generation, had exactly the same kind of background. I mean, Zeppo was kind of raised on his own, really, wasn't he? They'd already kind of headed out into the world and into the professional world in various ways. So he is an outsider in that sense, in a way that Gummo just isn't. So all those things that we think about with Zeppo being marginalized, you're absolutely right. It is much harder, isn't it, to imagine that being the dynamic.
I mean, even, you know, when they're sitting around in the, say, backstage kibitzing or whatever about their memories, Gummo's got the same memories. He has the same stories and so forth. And Zeppo was playing toys while these guys were in whorehouses or whatever, you know, hiding under the bed, you know, from some husband.
Yes, a lot of fans, and I think even a lot of experts when it comes to the Marx Brothers, don't quite make that connection. How Gummo was close in age to the three older brothers, and Zeppo really wasn't. He was dramatically younger than any of them. I think there's 14, 15 years between Zeppo and Chico.
Wow.
Which is a huge age gap for siblings.
Yeah. And given Chico, you know, that's young enough to be his son.
Yeah. Well, yeah, well, okay, it is.
14, 15.
It's young enough to be his son.
That, I mean, again, because we tend to think of them in the movies as much younger than they actually were, I think it's always a bit of a shock when people find out just how old they were when they made their first film. We tend to think of it as absurd, almost as an actual joke that Zeppo is playing Groucho's son in Horse.
Yeah, that's quite weird. Yeah, it's very strange.
It's not such a stretch, though, is it? It's not as absurd as you think.
Well, also for many years, most of us didn't know their real ages either. Like they were printed in books with the wrong years, even. It took a while for that to get really settled.
Being cast as Groucho's son in Horse Feathers, though, is one of Zeppo's clear inheritances from Gummo, who was Groucho's son in Home Again.
Ah.
With an even smaller age difference. I mean, Gummo's only a couple of years younger than Groucho, right?
Yeah.
Of course, in Home Again, Groucho had the old man get up. And
he was playing older, wasn't he? Yeah, yeah.
And well, I guess we'll hear some more about that at Mark's Fest as well, eh?
Yeah, that'll be quite something. Robert Bader and Paul Wesolowski. Robert S. Bader and Paul G. Wesolowski, with their middle initials, will be, delivering a talk about the history of Home Again, which is 110.
So as not to confuse them with the other Robert Bader and the other Paul.
That's right, yes. If you're planning to see Robert P. Bader and Paul W. Wesolowski, that's across the street at Ritz Fest.
No, I'm planning a Jerry Lewis Fest that gets a mighty close to our Ritz Fest.
All right.
Well, we've talked about your the emphasis you place on vaudeville, and that's that comes across in a particularly useful section that certainly was full of stuff that I didn't know, which is the section that you call vaudeville forerunners and mentors, which is full of interesting stuff. But I was also very much taken by your piece on other Harpos, which again is something I'd never given any thought to. And you have people there like Paul McCulloch and Gideon the Cat from Pinocchio.
I don't know if I ever did insert him into that listicle, but it occurred to me that some talking comedians remind me, comedians who do distracted professor characters like Professor Irwin Corey remind me of Harpo, you know, particularly when he makes his entrance as the titular professor in Animal Crackers. I think there it's more because he plays a musical instrument, but still that same idea, coming out in a big crazy coat with a big frizzy hair, making crazy faces. You know, there are a lot of comedians I think he influenced who it's not readily like. Another one might be Jack Gilford. Reminds me a little of Harpo, maybe because he's like sweet and he has this curly hair or whatever. Reminds me a lot of Harpo.
That is another one of those eternal questions, isn't it? To what extent is Harpo unique? To what extent is he part of a tradition? And even if he is part of a tradition, did he know he was part of a tradition? In which case, does it count?
Yeah, I researched it as best I could, but stuff like this doesn't really get written down. But I did get to wondering, because you can actually trace not just Chico, but Groucho in where they came from, you know, what traditions they drew from. You know, we think of Groucho as being like the Adam of stand-up comedians almost. But, you know, he didn't do stand-up, but most stand-ups in the generation that followed are kind of doing. When you look at early Burl was a bit younger than Groucho. I feel like he's kind of doing Groucho in some ways. But Harpo, that was kind of tough to trace. You know, one knows about silent clown characters, but there's no real cinematic record, for example. We know that they loved Charlie Chaplin and they met Charlie Chaplin. They all respected him, but his character's not very much like Chaplin.
No.
You know, silent comedy was flourishing then, but his sense of humor is less about the character thing, like, say, Laurel and Hardy's. You know, it's not about him wanting to do something or try something per se. It's about pulling the hot cup of coffee out of his, visual pun out of his trench coat kind of stuff. Yeah. But eventually it did dawn on me something really obvious in the same way, like, his grandmother played the harp. His grandfather was a magician, and magicians, and there are clown magicians, there's a whole tradition of that in entertaining. And I strongly sort of suspect, without any real evidence, that a lot of the impulse to make Harpo this magical elfin character happen might have something to do with his grandfather. Interesting, though, right? None of them, I don't know if any of them did magic tricks, per se. Aside from, like, Harpo's, you know, silverware falling out of his coat and stuff.
Yeah, Harpo, enormous dexterity with his hands and yeah, all that stuff, yeah. but never presented in the form of magic, is it? He does the equivalent of magic, of what could be yeah. magic tricks, but he's doing something else with that.
If they ran out of material, they could keep going in that direction, pulling stuff out of his hat. I really love the barking dog that comes out of his tattoo in Duck Soup. That's kind of like the acme of cinematic insanity in their movies.
You make a really interesting point about that in the early act, we all know that Harpo early on was playing an Irish character, and we've sort of long since processed that as part of our concept of the early Marx Brothers act, that Chico was Italian, but once upon a time, Groucho was doing a German character, and Harpo was doing Irish, and Gummo was doing Hebrew, quote-unquote. However, until your book comes along, I don't think anyone has made the point that playing an Irish character was an especially challenging speaking role for Harpo. Not just that he wasn't good at talking on stage, but that was a hard thing to do, a hard character to play, a hard accent to do, and with a significant Irish contingency in the audience, so that you would be doing it for a largely Irish crowd. And I wonder, your comments on that made me think, if Harpo had been given a different ethnic character to play earlier, maybe he never would have stopped talking on stage. Maybe we never would have gotten Harpo Marx.
He would have been a funnier Swede than L. Brendel. I pictured how nerve-wracking it would be to lampoon, and not just because lots of Irish people are in the audience, but for the first few decades of Variety and vaudeville and so forth, entertainment was largely dominated by Irish entertainers. So you had that too. You had the proliferation of Irish representations on stage to compete with too. It seems like a really high bar to have to hit, and you'd be just too glad to not have to do that anymore, I think.
Or just like for a European Jew to play an Italian is a much shorter walk than to play an Irish character.
Yeah. And also, you know, for it to succeed at the level of the Marx Brothers material usually does succeed, you'd want him to be able to break out into song and maybe clog dance and stuff if he's going to be the quote-unquote Irish guy. And I don't know if to what extent he possessed those skills. But we have heard Groucho do snatches of Irish in the movies. And we even heard Chico, is it at the circus? Or
Day at the Races.
Or Day at the Races, where he's a fake Italian doing a fake Irish.
I'm O'Reilly, the house detective.
Don't talk so loud. Your mustache will drop off.
Have you got a woman in here?
If I haven't, I've wasted 30 minutes of valuable time.
Well, you better get her out of here. This is the last time I'm going to tell you.
The last time? Can I depend on that?
Yes, because this time I'm going to stay all night.
It's a very special cinematic moment. Yes, it was a challenge. I don't know if he hit his mark, but no one else has done that before.
It goes right on that list. Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn. Here's looking at you, kid.
It does bring us to an interesting question, though, doesn't it? Which is the fact that they are doing stock characters, but they're doing something different with them. And I sometimes get the feeling, and I'm much less well versed in the early stuff than either of you are, so I'm kind of tiptoeing here. But I sometimes get the feeling that part of that edge that they had, or part of that distinction that they had, was that they weren't like kind of first generation vaudevillians. They were basically a singing act that pissed about a bit sometimes. But then when Al Sheen kind of corralled them, he said, right, you're going to do this kind of thing, and you're going to do this kind of thing. And they were sort of working to instruction rather than observation with anything that had, you know, that had grown up organically in the way that a lot of those acts had. They were kind of instantly doing their kind of mirror image of what they were being taught. Is there anything to that?
Yeah, there is, you know, and, you know, not to take obviously Groucho is the greatest comedian of the 20th century. You know, I'd probably fight someone in a bar over that. But that said, much like George Burns, say, or some other comedian, Edgar Bergen, say, especially in the early days, the way you learned to write comedy was you just steal the jokes out of Madison's Budget, which is the vaudeville humor magazine, and convert them and use them for yourself. You know, I'm sure that's what Al Sheen did. And stole bits from other comedians. And I mean, right away, the Marx Brothers are satirical. So I think to a large extent, when they would do appropriate that stuff, they'd also kind of make fun of it a little bit and so forth. But yeah, no, I think you're right. I think they absorbed stuff from others to an extent that's, you know, we watch those movies nowadays and we think of them as alien. It was kind of one of the reasons why I put that section in the book about, say, Clark and McCulloch and Gallagher and Sheen, Weber and Fields, because there's a context. They didn't sort of just fall from heaven.
Well, I would like to discuss some of your thoughts about the Algonquin Roundtable crowd and the Marx Brothers' connection to it. Sometimes among Marx Brothers fans, there is a tendency to overstate the literary greatness of the Algonquin Roundtable because it confers upon the Marx Brothers all of this highbrow legitimacy. And we like that about the Marx-Algonquin nexus, that the appeal the brothers had for these intellectual elites says something important about them, and it also sort of flatters us, doesn't it, as fans of the Marx Brothers. We like this team that the smartest people in the world liked in the 1920s. Now, many of the Algonquin Roundtable members were indeed great writers and literary greats, particularly great humorists. But they themselves were the first to disclaim the mantle of real literary greatness. I mean, Dorothy Parker was always saying that, no, the great writers are Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Dos Passos. None of them are having lunch with us.
Right.
They're all having lunch in Paris. And what we are doing is just having a lark, making up witty rhymes and poking fun at each other. And it's wonderful nonsense. And much as I love the Algonquin humorists, I think that's a really valid point. You write in the book that essentially the Algonquin crowd, they were the literary equivalent of show business. And that's why they were able to overlap so easily with the world of comedians and actors. They had half a foot in that world themselves. So true, and it doesn't take anything away from the Algonquinites to make this point. In fact, it underlines why they were maybe not elitists as much as we want them to be. They actually had their fingers closer to the pulse of mainstream popular culture than we want to think.
Yeah, we love to mythologize all of this. And they certainly, you know, Dorothy Parker certainly had the talent to create works of literary genius. And in small, you know, shorter pieces she did. But yeah, if you write for magazines, I mean, the main thing is like writing for magazines and newspapers. You have to churn stuff out daily. And then they become, you know, obviously, Georges Kaufman is a commercial playwright for Broadway, much more populist form than it is now in some ways. And then they become screenwriters, which has never been respected by anybody. You know, Faulkner wrote some hacky scripts. All of that, if you're like have a 9-to-5 job that's cranking out stuff, it's not conducive to locking yourself into a cabin for 6 months and writing like the big giants of the time did. So it's why a lot of those guys, including Kaufman, you know, were on panel shows when TV came along, you know, and radio. But yeah, they didn't, there's no epic poem by any of them.
Yeah, it's not to slight them. It's just to correctly categorize them, I think. I mean, personally, I'd rather read Robert Benchley than Ernest Hemingway, you know.
Yeah.
But there is a real valid point there. You also lament, as many of us probably have, that Alexander Wolcott didn't survive more into the age of panel shows. And boy, he is really missing from that scene once you start thinking about it that way, isn't he?
Yeah, because you just know he would toss out really funny remarks from time to time. And also be a character. I'm sure his voice has been captured. I don't know that I've heard it, but I imagine him having a really sort of flamboyant and arch way of delivering his witticisms.
Oh, yeah, there's a Town Crier episode or two that you can find on the internet. And yeah, he sounds, as Harpo describes in Harpo Speaks, Will Cutts' voice sounds like the air being let out of a balloon.
British audiences, only British audiences of a certain age, have no need to sort of imagine that, because I don't know if you've heard of him, but we had this guy in the 1950s called Gilbert Harding, who was kind of like the first television celebrity in Britain who owed his fame to nothing else but television. So he was a personality, but he was referred to as the rudest man in Britain. He had this bristling moustache. He was very bombastic. He was basically Sheridan Whiteside. That's basically what he was. And he was, for instance, one of the regulars on the British version of What's My Line. And he would constantly sort of needle and complain and insult and criticize the people and the format in exactly the way that you could imagine Woolcott doing.
Was he a newspaper man before
he was,
TV?
He was a newspaper man. Yeah, he was a newspaper man. He died very suddenly in 1960. He dropped dead on the steps of the British Broadcasting House and kind of vanished from the culture ever after. So not many people know him now, but I he's a big favorite of mine. One day I'll write a biography of him. Really fascinating bloke, but he's basically Sheridan Whiteside made real, and that is exactly the role that you could imagine Woolcott doing on panel shows and things,
not terribly different from the role that Oscar Levant did play on some of those kind of shows, although Woolcott had a more generous and expansive humanistic sort of take on things. He wasn't quite the bitter wit that Levant was, but you could imagine him as a sort of crotchety, looking down his nose the kind of panelist on especially in 50s and 60s panel shows.
Bennett Cerf was a panelist.
Yeah.
I mean, it was crazy. People read things back then.
Right. Yeah. Publishers. So the celebrity publisher.
Yeah. That would just never happen now. Yes. It's crazy. Yeah.
Who's your favorite publisher? Well, Ben Omard is obvious. Well, I would be remiss not to ask you a question, or at least raise the subject of the I'll Say She Is of it all. A portion of the book is devoted to I'll Say She Is, and particularly the work that you and I did together, Trav, on the revival of I'll Say She Is. Sure, many of our listeners are aware, so I won't belabor the point, that when I was first trying to figure out what to do with my adaptation of I'll Say She Is, and if there was any possible way to put it on stage, I brought it to Trav, who I only vaguely knew at the time, but just sensed that he would be receptive to the idea that this project needed care and attention. And the care and attention that Trav and I gave it together took it to the original Marx Fest, where it premiered as a staged reading, and then to the 2014 New York Fringe Festival. And if you've read my book, Give Me a Thrill, where I talk about those experiences, your book, Trav, provides a sort of interesting Rashomon, like the same story from another angle.
Indeed.
Including the story of our first conversation, which took place in Times Square. And we both do the same thing in our respective books. I introduce you, I describe like what you were wearing and how your personality struck me when we first met. So interesting to read the same scene through your eyes in your book.
I wanted to tell you the bit where I meet and describe you was much longer and read like a friar's roast, and I cracked myself up so much. But I was like, oh no, he's going to think this is too mean. I went down like 10 or 12 sort of like real sort of zingers.
Wow.
I clipped it down to your wardrobe, I think. At this point,
yes, the Maoist severity, which is totally fair. It's absolutely true. I don't know why I wear a black jacket to the beach, but I do.
My enthusiasm when we first met was just I want to see it. If nothing else had transpired from our meeting together and so forth, I just would have been one of the many who came and reveled in the chance to see this thing that I had imagined in my head for decades. So thank you for being born.
Well, likewise.
And some of the things you did subsequently.
Well, thank you for helping me birth the revival of I'll Say She Is. And you know, one of the things that made me bring it to you was the sense that it was, at least as far as my own resources and know-how could cover, it was unproducible. You know, I was somebody who had produced a lot of downtown theater, you know, a lot of self-produced indie, homemade, handmade theater. And I had a feeling about I'll Say She Is that because it was the Marx Brothers' work, you know, it wasn't just my thing that I could screw up and nobody would mind. And because it was, in my mind, a big Broadway musical, I felt like this is unproducible. I can't do it. And I'm not sure anyone who can do it can be trusted with it. And your crucial insight, as far as producing the show, for me, your crucial insight was no, it is just as producible as anything else. And in fact, it's eminently producible because a scrappy review, independently produced from 1924, actually is closer to what we would now consider downtown theater or indie theater than what we think of as a big, lavish, giant Broadway musical, and that it would be appropriate to produce it in what I think of as the downtown style, populate it with burlesque artists and performing artists and comedians, and put it on like a show, like the same homemade shows that you and I independently had been producing all along. And so, like, it's the yes, you can aspect of your approach to the show that made it possible for me.
This happened once before with Ed Wood's Orgy of the Dead. A couple of decades before I'll Say She Is, we were doing an Ed Wood Fest, and people were like, oh, well, you can't do Orgy of the Dead. And I was like, no, we're surrounded by burlesque dancers. We'll just do it, you know. And we did Orgy of the Dead. So it's very similar. It's like people, there's a, you know, burlesque can make a show. But also, I wanted to say, Noah and I met with various people in the commercial theater world, and we did hit plenty of naysaying. People like this, they didn't like that, but they thought about things in terms of the contemporary commercial landscape and what people want from a show. And one of the top people we met with, commercial producer, I had a nice long conversation with him afterwards, and one of the things he liked about it, counterintuitively and against kind of the conventional wisdom of some of the sort of middling producers we met with. This was a big Broadway guy we met with. And he liked the scrappy nature. You know, we've reached a point, you know, this is the age of So You Think You Can Dance and Everybody's Got Talent. And maybe once 100 people were trying for a Broadway role, and now it's 10,000 people are trying for that same spot. So the expectations of commercial theater audiences tend to be that every singer has to be the greatest singer in the world. Every dancer has to be the greatest dancer in the world. And they have to be kind of machines of performing, which is fine. I'm not going to like naysay talent. But back in the day, okay, Bert Lahr and Fanny Brice, these people are not machines. They're really funny, big personalities who can deliver. And so, you know, that spirit, or even if you go and you watch Gold Diggers of 1933 or 42nd Street, it's not a precision drill team chorus. Even back then, I mean, you had the director snarling at the women to pep it up.
Sell it, girls, sell it.
Yeah, you know, there's a certain amount of that. But, you know, there's a charm in seeing in 2000, in this century, the 21st century, there can be a charm in seeing non-perfection but personality. You know, we don't have the resources to get women who might otherwise be rockettes in our cast. We've got great burlesque dancers and great comedians and actors and so forth who were in our budget and had the charm of the Little Rascals putting on the variety show kind of basically. And you know, one of the greatest Groucho impersonators on planet Earth.
Oh, good. He sounds like a nice guy, but it really is true. All that is really true, and it really set the tone for the project going forward. It remains the tone for the project. You know, the 2016 Off-Broadway production that Amanda Sisk directed had a slightly more musical theater orientation to it, but it certainly held on to that downtown feeling, and that's what the Alsatia's revival is, you know. And when we've had those kind of semi-exciting meetings with commercial theater people, and Trav and I had a bunch of those meetings, and Amanda and I have had a bunch of those meetings too. One of the things that tends to happen is you wind up realizing that a show of any size is considered a commercial anathema now, you know. I mean, one of the things about Alsatia's is in order to convey this 1920s revue feeling, you need those chorus, you need those women, that line of chorus girls, you know. You just need a cast of a certain size. You've also got, instead of the usual one protagonist, you have four protagonists, or you another way to look at it is one protagonist and four totally extra characters who would just be the comic relief in any other conventional show. And so, you know, it's a big show now. There's not a lot of shows on Broadway with an Alsatia's sized cast. I just saw Frank Ferrante's production of Groucho, A Life in Review in Philadelphia. And that was, for a modern day Marx Brothers production, very lavish. You know, it was a big, beautiful, exquisitely designed professional production. But, you know, with a cast of three or four, maybe three, and then and one. I guess that makes four. But anyway, you hear what I'm saying. Alsatia's is a huge show, unavoidably.
It's a thrill to see a full dance chorus. There's like no substitute once you have. It's really enjoyable.
Well, we could go on all day picking the bones clean of this book, but then that would give you no reason to go out and buy your own copy. So we will call a halt there. The book is called The Marx Brothers Miscellany. It's from Bear Manor Media and available from all the usual outlets. Is it out now or is it out?
It has snuck out. It has snuck out without me. So you can buy it at Bear Manor. Yeah, I'm planning a big launch to happen at Marx Fest, but it's already available, so by all means, please buy it. Nothing in there about Dr. Crippen, I'm afraid, Matthew.
So yeah, if they buy, they can buy a copy and they can take the copy to Marx Fest, and I dare say you'd be willing to scribble your name on the front.
Love to.
Yeah, okay.
In someone else's blood.
Well, before we say goodbye to you properly, we'll be back in a moment to ask you your choice of final song. So if you haven't got that prepared, you can start thinking about that now while I hand over to Noah for a Patreon and Marxfest update.
Thank you, Matthew. Well, in Patreon news, sitting right in front of me as we record this is the stack of postcards about to go to the mailbox. They're all stamped and addressed. And this new postcard, this month's postcard, has a beautiful design by our friend Emma Levitt. Emma's name is perhaps familiar to our listeners because recently, at the end of last year, Emma won our Captain Spaulding Sergeant Pepper postcard contest. And so somewhere in Emma's home or workplace, perhaps, hangs a beautiful Coconuts poster signed by Groucho Marx that Emma won in our contest. Well, she is also an extremely gifted designer and has created a postcard design that I think you're going to love. And shortly after we wrap this recording, I'm going to go put it in the mailbox. So you'll probably see it in person around the same time you listen to this episode. In Marxfest news, yeah, we're getting close. We are recording this in late April of 2024. Marxfest begins May 17th, 2024, and happens those last two weekends. Tickets are selling. If you plan to be there and haven't gotten your tickets yet, you're going to want to do that. Marxfest.org is where to go for tickets and information. And yeah, that's that. It's all terribly exciting. I will say about Marxfest, it's overwhelming. Every time we try to list the events, we run out of breath or space. It is really an embarrassment of riches. In fact, there's a huge event we're adding to our Friday, May 17th schedule with a significant descendant of a major Marx Brothers co-star.
A significant descendant of a major Marx Brothers co-star.
It is Christopher Hart, the son of Kitty Carlisle and Moss Hart.
Cool.
Who met the Marx Brothers when he was a child and will tell us all about it.
Yay.
Okay, well, thanks once again, Travesty, for joining us. It's been an absolute thrill, a positive pleasure, and a genuine delight.
And thank you, guys. I'm thrilled to be here. Very thrilled.
You are now tasked with coming up with our final song. It doesn't have to have any connection to the Marx Brothers anywhere other than in your own head. You have a completely free hand. What's it going to be?
The first thing, we'll go with automatic writing. The first thing that popped into my head was the that song they sing in Go West, because I always forget that it exists. And it's, you know, we always think of Groucho playing guitar in Monkey Business and Horse Feathers. He actually does play it in Go West with that hokey song. Does that work?
Yeah, Riding the Range.
Riding the Range. I'm sorry.
The horses do the work, so we don't care. It's clippity-clop, just clippity-clop. Riding the reins together. It's a lonesome road and mighty long, but the hoofbeats make a mighty pretty song of clippity-clop. You think this riding, this constant riding, is something that can't be done. But all day Sunday, we've got till Monday just to ride around for fun.
Riding the reins
together. Where the men are men and life is free, and there's nothing breaking the monotony of
clippity-clop.
Just clippity-clop.
I sure like horses, and I say a horse is really a man's best friend.
Wah, wah, wah.
You won't like riding when you start riding, but it'll get you in the end.
Riding
the reins
together.
My father shot at the Indians in 1862.
Oh, he sure the shot at the stalker when the stalker he brought to you.
Clippity-clop.
Oh, my heart is beating.
Clippity-clop.
Yeah.
Marx Brothers Council Podcast is produced by Bob Cassell. Matthew Conium's books, including The Annotated Marx Brothers, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, and That's Me, Groucho, are published by McFarland. Noah Diamond's book, Give Me a Thrill, The Story of Alsatias, is published by Beer Manor Media. To leave a comment and for more info about this and all episodes, visit us at Marx Brothers Council Podcast.com. For the latest Marx Brothers and podcast news, follow us on X or Twitter or both and join the fun with the largest and most vibrant Marx community online, a club that will have someone like you as a member, the Marx Brothers Council Facebook group. That's it for now. Swordfish!
That's it, you guessed it.